This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, technology advice for the non-technological. But first, at one time, an HIV-positive diagnosis was considered a death sentence. But that's changed. Thanks to years of research and advances in treatment, someone with HIV today can have a normal lifespan and live a life similar to someone without HIV. There is still a strong stigma attached to the disease, but even those perceptions are slowly evolving. Joining us to discuss the changing reality and perception of HIV/AIDS are University of Cincinnati Infectious Disease Center HIV Certified Practice Nurse Jan Stockton, the Cincinnati leader for the National Women and Girls HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, Rose Todd Stanford, and Cincinnati Men's Chorus 25th Anniversary Committee member Bruce Preston. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jan, Rose, and Bruce, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Rose, the history of HIV and AIDS, it started with such fear and there was illness and death. How much have things changed since we first encountered the disease in those early days?
Well, it depends on the community, because in some communities, it still has that stigma. It still has that fear. It is still that stuff, especially with the African-American community. They just still see it as that stuff in nicest of terms. They haven't actually, I guess, accepted that there's an HIV virus that can cause AIDS. It's still kind of all one big AIDS diagnosis. If you're HIV positive, you're infectious and you're going to die and everybody around you is going to die. So it kind of depends on the community that you're in. In other communities, it has really kind of gotten better, where people are really more accepting that a person has HIV, understanding that HIV doesn't necessarily cause AIDS and that people are living longer and healthier. So it just depends on the community. It depends on the community that's discussing it.
Jan, how do you see how the perceptions have changed over the years?
I would agree with Rose. There's been some very positive changes in certain communities and more struggles in others. I think for me, until recently, I was the HIV intake nurse for the infectious disease clinic at University of Cincinnati. And what was very striking for me was the number of people coming in newly diagnosed who were young, who were in their late teens, their early 20s. And for them, while they have grown up in a world that had HIV, I mean, that's their memory. They have no, they've got no experience with a world that HIV wasn't already a part of. But now it's something that they have to deal with directly. And so many of them, even though they're engaging in behaviors that we've known all along put people at risk for HIV infection, it really, really comes as a huge shock. We see a lot of the individual responses to the stigma that still exists, unfortunately, in so many parts of our community, our country, the world, things that here in the 21st century you would think we would have moved past, but unfortunately have not.
It's been a struggle still.
Yeah.
A struggle.
Yeah, yeah. And oftentimes, while Rose is aware of the fact that you can live and live well with HIV infection, living a normal lifespan with HIV infection, but never having an AIDS diagnosis, when I would share that with people who were coming in for their first visit, that often came as a big shock.
Jan, explain the difference between HIV and AIDS. If someone has HIV, does it necessarily mean that they have AIDS?
No, it does not. It means you're living with a viral infection. HIV, unlike other viruses like measles and the flu, it is not a virus that your immune system will eventually clear itself of. So it becomes chronic or longstanding. And as long as people are tested and identified early on in their in the process of the infection, get enrolled into care, get on treatment, they can have a good quality of life. Having started into HIV care back in 1991, where really we had little more to offer than a hand to hold and a shoulder to cry on, now we have some outstanding medications, one pill once a day combinations with minimal side effects, good results. So people have a much, much better quality of life in addition to having that extended life period that people can live a normal lifespan with HIV infection, but never developing a diagnosis of AIDS.
Whereas you were diagnosed in 1993 with HIV, yes. What has life been like for you?
Oh, wow. Do you have the next 2 hours?
23 years in just a few minutes.
23 years in a few minutes. HIV definitely made a dramatic change in my life. Initially, like Jan said, as a newly infected person, and in 1993, there wasn't much hope. And so initially it was like, okay, I'm going to be dead in 10 years. Well, by 1998, they came out with these wonderful medications called protease inhibitors. And so my doctor started me on the protease inhibitors, which actually have increased my lifespan. The protease, and there's other medications available now, but with the new medications, it actually slows down the process of the virus. So that increases the lifespan because the virus is not reproducing as fast as it would without the medication. So I'm living longer, and that's a wonderful thing. But living longer, you start to get older.
And all the problems that come with that.
And all the problems that come with getting, with getting older are starting to appear. So it's been good. It's been long. I'm, been happy majority of the time. I've been blessed not to have had an AIDS diagnosis. Basically, AIDS diagnosis means that your immune system has become so weak that you can't fight off other infections. And that's what people die from. And so my immune system has been acting pretty good with the medication. I can regularly see my doctor. That has made a change in my life because I now see my doctor really on a regular basis, at least every 3 to 6 months. And I'm taking better care of my body and my health than I probably would I did before I was infected with the virus. Because then you kind of feel like, oh, I'm okay, nothing's wrong, my blood pressure's good, my heart is good, I'm okay. And unfortunately, and I'll just share this real quickly, I had a daughter who died in August of 2013. She was 32 years old, and she was diagnosed with high blood pressure around May of that year. But not as such, the case wasn't bad enough for her to get medications yet. The doctor just said, oh, your blood pressure is kind of high, watch your diet. Well, in August 17th, she went to sleep and actually died from heart failure from the blood pressure. So, for me, that was an example of, even though we think we're so healthy and, doing so well, that being HIV positive has given me a different look on how I live. It's like I take better care of myself. I just do the things that I need to do to stay healthy.
You take any extra precautions because you have HIV?
Oh, yes. Well, initially, I was so afraid of other people making me sick.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wore gloves and mask things just to protect myself from other people. I can remember early on, I wouldn't, like I had friends who had new babies or newborns, I would not touch the babies. Even my kids, for a while, it was like I didn't, if I would cut myself cooking, then I would make sure that I didn't touch them with that hand, because I was afraid of, even though I knew better, it was just that fear that someone else I know could get infected with this virus and have to live with that. That was the scariest thought for me. And then when other people, I came to realize that other people were actually more dangerous to me
than you were to them.
Than I were to them. Because if they were, you know, if we weren't intimate in any kind of way, then you could not get the virus.
Right, casual contact is not going to transmit HIV.
But you got to cough and go, ha, 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 and then next thing you know, I'm in ICU.
Sure. Hey, Janice, is that a major problem for someone with HIV, the greater chance of getting colds, flu, things like that from other people?
It depends on how well they're managing their health. And fortunately for Rose, she's obviously done a really good job. But it is things like making sure that you take the medications that are prescribed for you, the way that they're prescribed for you, not missing doses, because that's how you help your immune system fight off the virus and to keep it under control. Making sure that you get your checkups, those kinds of things. And no matter how low your T cell count is, the T cells are the cells of the immune system that are selectively picked off by the virus. And those T cells have a unique responsibility. They organize and coordinate and communicate among all of the other white blood cells that make up your immune system. So when the coordinators have been eliminated or seriously depleted, you can have all of the other cells of the immune system sitting there waiting for that call to arms that isn't going to come simply because your T cell count is down. But eventually, people who have very low T cell counts, even T cell counts of zero, once they get on the newer medications that we are so fortunate to have now, eventually their CD4 count, their T cell count will go back up. Oftentimes it will approach normal range, if not actually get right back up in there. For some people, because of that, we're starting from a pretty low point. It'll take a little bit of time to get there. But we tell people, you know, to just be judicious about being around other people. We let them know that, you know, whereas other people may say, I don't need a flu shot, we're not going to force you to take one, but we're going to strongly encourage it. Because even if your numbers are up, we know that your immune system function is not going to be 100%. It may be 95%, it may be 90%, but we just want to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to take really good care of that person's immune system. So the immune system can then take really good care of that individual person.
Initially, when I first told my children, they were young teenagers, and I couldn't tell them until I had really got informed myself about HIV, about what I was living with, so that I could answer any questions they may have. And so when I first told them about it, I said, you know, my T cells are affected by stress. So you cannot stress me. You'll cause my T cells to go low. So maybe the first year, you know, it's like that worked.
That was a silver lining to the whole thing.
But then after about a year, they was like, oh, you ain't going nowhere. You know, we're going to get on your nerves like we used to.
We will continue our discussion about HIV/AIDS, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the changing reality and perception of HIV/AIDS, our University of Cincinnati Infectious Disease Center HIV Certified Practice Nurse Jan Stockton, the Cincinnati leader for the National Women and Girls HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, Rose Todd Stanford, and Cincinnati Men's Chorus 25th Anniversary Committee member, Bruce Preston. Bruce, do you think that HIV and AIDS has, as to a point, been pushed to the background today as far as the amount of media coverage that it gets?
Well, I think in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I was listening to Rose talk about how AIDS has changed for her from the 90s to the present. As a gay male of a certain age, I was just coming out and in my 20s back in the late 80s, early 90s, when AIDS was becoming a big deal and was in the news a lot. Then that generation, a lot of them passed. The new generation that I see of young gay men coming up, think of it as an old man's disease. They don't think it's something that affects them. They think now that PrEP is available, they can take a pill. And much like the birth control pill for women, now I can have sex and not worry about getting pregnant. With PrEP, young men think, oh, now I can have sex and not worry about getting HIV. Also, as Jan mentioned, with the treatments that are available now, people can live much longer lives. And so it's almost looked at like, well, diabetes, I can manage it. It's not such a big deal.
Looked at as a chronic disease.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what they're not realizing is that's not really the case. And so I think while you don't see AIDS as much in the news, you hear stories about PrEP, you hear stories about the treatment that's available. But what I see among especially younger gay men, and I mean men in their 20s, is a kind of, you have that attitude as a young man, nothing's going to affect me, I'm going to live forever. And they're emboldened by these treatments and think, well, I'm not going to get it, and even if I do, it's not a big deal. Until they do get it and realize it is a very big deal.
And they find out how life-altering this really is. So what is PrEP, by the way?
PrEP is an abbreviation for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's a strategy for doing something to prevent infection before the exposure takes place. And it's a term that's used for a lot of different illness prevention types. But yes, but right now, the PrEP that you're hearing about has to do with HIV. There have been a number of studies that have shown that there's a tablet that contains two HIV medications, tenofovir and emtricitabine. They are commonly used in HIV treatment. HIV treatment is three medications at least, and sometimes more. But we have found that by taking these two medications that come combined together already in one tablet, you take that once a day, and you can reduce your risk of becoming HIV infected if you are exposed. It is not something that you do just by itself. It is not permission to have condomless sex. It needs to be done in combination. And it needs to be done every day. It cannot be an on-again, off-again thing. One of the other things that we've learned really very recently is that PrEP in women is not necessarily the same as PrEP in men. The medication that we give for PrEP, for HIV PrEP, takes longer to penetrate vaginal and cervical tissues to the point that the woman is protected if she engages in vaginal sex. It takes about 3 weeks of medication every day. For men or for women who engage in anal sex, the GI tract tends to absorb the medication much more efficiently, and so the tissues are protected probably after about 7 days of PrEP. So we have to be very careful when we're educating people who are thinking that this might be a good health promotion strategy, that we don't present it as something simpler than it actually is. We don't do anyone any favors by doing that. But for people who have been able to take PrEP consistently and use condoms, there have been rates of protection of around 85% to 95%.
Now, is PrEP, what's the term, antiretroviral? Is that what
it is? It actually is a combination of two antiretrovirals, yes.
Okay. 513-419-7100, if you'd like to join us. How much has the area of testing improved, too? That's something that's changed immensely.
Significantly, absolutely.
I remember my first test was for HTLV-3. That's how old I am. Which is before we had a name for AIDS. It was the human T-cell leukemia virus 3, and that's what they would screen for. Are you proud?
Yes, very good.
But it used to be literally, I used to liken it to a ritual because you had to go in and confess all your sins. What have you done? Who have you done it with? There was a bloodletting, and then you had to wait a week to get your results.
Oh, what a great week, I bet.
Right?
That was, too.
Talk about penance. Then you would come in and find out what your status was and what your status was on the day that you tested a week ago. Now you can get in the grocery store oral swabs and find out right away whether or not you've been exposed. So testing can be as rapid as that.
I like the rapid testing, but I've been against the over-the-counter test for a long time because you don't get that counseling piece.
Good point.
And that counseling piece, the testing is so important. I know it may seem like a lot of personal information, like who you've been with and how, you know, all those things, but that's a part of the counseling piece to take a look at what risk behaviors you have involved in and how maybe we can help you change those risks. When I was diagnosed, the test was a 2-week, it was a venipuncture test, mm-hmm. a blood test that drew the blood. You waited 2 weeks. And this may be part of the reason why I became so infatuated with learning more about HIV and being an advocate. Because 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from a doctor. Well, first call I got was from the social worker from the clinic. And she said, well, your blood, something happened to the vial with your blood in it. It got broken or something. We need you to come back in and be retested. I was like, okay, but it's time I was doing something. And so I wasn't in no big hurry. I had been tested previously before. It was always negative. No big deal. I'll be up there when I get there. Well, I guess I didn't get there fast enough because the next call I got was from a doctor, the doctor of the clinic. He said, Rose, your test came back positive, and we need you to come back in and be retested. To this very day, it's been 23 years, I don't remember leaving my home. I don't remember from my home to the clinic. I have no recollection of that time. I'm grateful that I made it there. And I remember being there, and the case manager, a social worker, was talking to me, and she was sounding like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, wah, 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 wah.
But it was in one ear out the other.
I didn't even hear it. It's like just lips moving. What I could hear was this voice saying, Rose, you need to tell what is happening to you so that maybe, just maybe, it won't happen to someone else. And I kept hearing this little small, still voice. But I've been against that over-the-counter testing and giving people results over the phone because you don't know how that person is going to react. And if you don't have that counseling piece, it can be, you know, very devastating for folks. And, you know, maybe even send them into that snap personality, whether they become homicidal or suicidal. And so that counseling piece is so important to even giving a negative result, because we have to look at, and I did HIV testing for many years for several organizations here in Cincinnati. But then we get to look at what behaviors may have put you at risk and how can we help you not make those same you know, continue those same behaviors. And if the results is positive, then we can help you look at getting into treatment and definitely curbing those behaviors so that you don't pass it on to someone else. But without that counseling piece, it's just a test and ain't no telling what the results will be.
Yeah. You make a good point. I have a friend who 2 years ago was told by his primary care doctor after a regular physical over the telephone, you tested positive, you need to go talk to somebody.
2 years ago?
2 years ago.
Oh, gosh.
So even though, yes, we've come so far, I mean, 30 years ago, the clinic was the only place to get tested. Mm-hmm. Now, but still with medical professionals, I think there needs to be a little more education and sensitivity. That's not a conversation that should happen over
the phone.
No, that
isn't a conversation that should take place over the phone. And I'm really sorry that your friend went through that.
Yeah.
I have to do something real quickly here, and then we can get back to the conversation.
Okay.
But I want to say thanks to Candy Coleman for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. And go ahead, Jan. Sorry.
So one of the things that's happened that I've seen is that when I started at the clinic, I'm going to say it was like about 13 years ago, the percentage of people who were HIV positive in the United States but didn't know it was 1 in 4. It is now 1 in 8. So we are definitely doing better than we had been in the past. Not where we should be, but a heck of a lot better than what we had been doing in the past. And so I have to applaud the emergency rooms, the primary care doctors, the clinic staff, the OB people, all of our colleagues in healthcare who have recognized the importance of not waiting until someone is on a ventilator in the intensive care unit to offer an HIV test. Y'all out there don't know how many lives you have saved by doing routine HIV testing.
It's much simpler than it used to be, but I still have to wonder how many people are still reluctant to get the test done. How much of a barrier is that?
I'm not sure. I think, though, one of the things that we have done differently that may make people feel a little more comfortable when they're asked about it is we have gone from an opt-in approach to an opt-out approach, where with opt-in, it's like, well, we're going to do all of these tests for you, and if you'd like an HIV test, we'll do that as well. By framing it that way, you kind of you leave the person feeling like if I admit that I'd like an HIV test, that I'm saying,
yeah,
oh, I've done something horrid.
I have an exposure.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. I've done something that I shouldn't have done. And so, yes, I should be tested. By saying we're going to do this panel of tests and we include an HIV test in there. If you'd rather not have one, you know, we'll not do it. But we do one for everybody because that's just our routine.
It should be a part of a wellness check.
It should be
check.
A part
just,
of wellness check.
Just
you're
as you have to know your cholesterol.
Right.
Just like you check your cholesterol and everything else. Yeah.
Everything else. Yeah.
But again, I think that brings up my concern is that the results and that counseling piece with the results.
Right.
Because that was one of our you know, one of the things we were concerned about with doctors doing this as a routine test, because some doctors just kept, you know, they didn't really have that bedside type manner. And so we were afraid that doctors would come and say, oh, here's your test results. You got HIV, and go out the door. Mm-hmm. So again, what happens to that counseling piece? I can speak for myself. If I don't know where I would be if I didn't have that social worker, and then immediately they took me to the health department, and I met with a wonderful lady there, Debbie Tripp, who was HIV counselor.
Oh,
yes.
Yes.
And to have them sit down and talk with me, that if I had to just, like I said, when I get this call over the phone, you know, where could I have my brain, mind, and wind. So there's still a concern is the results. It's getting people tested, but, you know, giving the results in an appropriate way.
So I guess the message then is to healthcare professionals who are out there and for healthcare profession students, please, you know, we really appreciate you doing HIV testing, but at some point, you're probably going to get a positive comeback. And if you're not sure how the best way to handle that with the individual patient, please feel free to call the MATEC office, Midwest AIDS Training and Education office, at 513-584-2422, or call the ID, the Infectious Disease Physician Group, in whatever health practice you're in, and talk to their staff, because they'll know what the best way to present this information in a kind, compassionate, respectful way, so that people aren't being knocked off their chair when they may be home alone or at the end of a really crummy day when right. this is just the icing on the cake.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, Rose, thank you for bringing that up.
And, Bruce, as we finish up, I want you to tell us about the 25th anniversary of the Cincinnati Men's Chorus and how you're commemorating that 25th anniversary.
We have this is our 25th season, and we have a concert next weekend that we're doing at Christ Church Cathedral. And so to celebrate that anniversary, we reached back to our history, and really the history of gay men's choral movement and AIDS are intertwined with each other. Gay men's choruses began and immediately began singing at memorial services. So we're bringing in four blocks of panels from the AIDS Memorial Quilt that will be displayed at Christ Church Cathedral downtown on 4th Street, starting 1 week from today, next Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The church is open at 8 in the morning, and people are welcome to walk in and look at the panels. Each block has 8 panels, and we've curated the show, or the display rather, so that each block contains panels that relate to Cincinnati, including a panel that the men's chorus submitted. Along with that, because we didn't want to do that out of context, we'll be having HIV testing on site at Christ Church Cathedral from noon until 4 on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday next week. And people can get testing, they can get prevention information, and that's being done by Caracol and Planned Parenthood. Then we're going to have 1 week from tomorrow, on March 31st, there will be a panel discussion. It's hosted by Andy Ruffner, who's a social worker and a former Cincinnati Men's Chorus member. And it will feature Rose. We're also going to have Scott Knox talking about legal issues and how that's changed over the last 30 years. We'll have a medical professional and another young individual who's living with HIV to talk about some of the things we've talked about today, what's going on currently with HIV/AIDS. So we wanted to not only celebrate our 25th anniversary, but really reach back to some of the things that were going on at the time the chorus was founded. And this seemed to be a good demonstrable visual way to kind of talk about where we came from, and then the panel and some of the other things we'll talk about where we are today.
And we have a link to more information at our website, WVXU.org. And Jan, Rose, and Bruce, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Invite us again.
You'll do that, Rose.
Okay.
University of Cincinnati Infectious Disease Center HIV Certified Practice Nurse Jan Stockton, the Cincinnati leader for the National Women and Girls HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, Rose Todd Stanford, and Cincinnati Men's Chorus 25th Anniversary Committee member Bruce Preston.